The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome Philip Bobbitt.
Thank you, Andy. It's nice to be at a library. I want to begin by telling you a story about a library. When my mother died, I went to her green writing desk, and I've forgotten what I was looking for, but I found a cache of cards that had a sort of index-sized cards that had a hole in the top that were filled with snatches of poetry and lofty sayings. There must have been 100 of them. So I took them to my father and I said, "What is all this?" He said, "Well, you know, I met your mother at the Library of Congress." And I said, I knew that. He said, "Well, I was working my way through college. She was taking a graduate degree in what was called library science." I said, "I knew that." He said, "Did you know that she was engaged to another man?" And I said, I think I'd forgotten that. He said, "Yes," he said, "she was engaged, and we had a very strict supervisor. So we would communicate to each other by means of these cards, actually the card holes in the bottom, pretending that we were exchanging cards in the Dewey Decimal System." And by this means, my father prized my mother away from this guy. So I have a special fondness for librarians. I want to read you something that begins my book. There are three stanzas from a poem by Czesław Miłosz. And it very appropriately is titled "A Poem for the End of the Century." When everything was fine, and the notion of sin had vanished, and the earth was ready in universal peace to consume and rejoice without creeds and utopias, unknown reasons, surrounded by the books of prophets and theologians, of philosophers, poets, searched for an answer, scowling, grimacing, waking up at night, muttering at dawn. What oppressed me so much was a bit shameful. Talking of it aloud would show neither tact nor prudence. It might even seem an outrage against the health of mankind. What was keeping me up at night? What was responsible for all that scowling and grimacing in my case was the growing conviction that almost every widely held idea that we currently entertain about terrorism and warfare is wrong and must be thoroughly rethought. The looming combination of a global terrorist network, weapons of mass destruction, and the heightening vulnerability of enormous numbers of civilians require, in my view, a basic transformation of conventional wisdom in the area of international security. Among well-informed persons, the kind of persons who come to a talk like this, a number of propositions about 21st century terror and warfare are widely and tenaciously held. I'm going to list some of these, and I ask you to ask yourself if you don't, in fact, hold many of these. For example, that terrorism has always been with us, and though its weapons may change, it will remain fundamentally the same, the weapon of the weak seeking to wrest political control from the strong. That because terrorism will always be with us, there can be no victory in a war against terror. That the very notion of a war on terror is at best a public relations locution, like the war on drugs or the war on poverty, because there's no enemy state against which such a war can be waged. I saw a headline in a satirical magazine that I like that said, "Flash from war on drugs. Drugs win." That terrorism cannot be an enemy, the object of warfare, because it is a method, a technique, even if a sinister and brutal one. But because terrorism is a technique, not an ideology, it is always a means to an end. That because terrorism is only a means to an end, that is, because it's not distinguished by any particular objective or goal, provos and loyalists can both be terrorists, so they're pursuing diametrically opposed political agenda. And because of this, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. It's just a matter of perspective. That the root causes of terrorism lie in the conditions of poverty, economic exploitation, neglect of health and education, and religious indoctrination that can and must be reversed before wars against terror can be won. That terrorism is best treated as a problem of crime by law enforcement officials and not as a matter for defense departments, which are inappropriate when there are no battlefield lines or armies to confront. But if, on the other hand, terrorism is a matter of warfare, there can be no place for the Geneva Conventions or other rules of law that are applied in conventional conflicts. That good intelligence provides the decisive key to defeating terrorism. That terrorism will not flourish in democracies. That the more power governments gain, the weaker the civil liberties that belong to the public. Don't most of us believe that? That there's a kind of needle that oscillates between emergencies and tranquility, and when it goes in one direction, the government gets more power and we retain fewer rights, and when it goes in the other direction, the government is weakened and we have greater rights. The terrorists win if they're able to force governments to enhance their powers of detention, surveillance, or information collection, or if the citizenry significantly modifies its everyday behavior. I live about half a year in London, and there's a long-running column there called Bridget Jones's Diary. You may have seen some of the movies that were made of this. Bridget Jones has several issues with her mother. She thinks her mother drinks too much. She thinks she spends too much shopping. And in one of these diary notes, the mother comes in one afternoon. She's clearly been drinking, and she's also been shopping. And Bridget Jones is just giving her a terrible time. And the mother says, "Don't you understand, darling, if we change our habits, the terrorists win." That 21st century terrorism is the result of a clash of international cultures when medieval and backward worlds confront modern secular societies. That the threat from terrorist attacks comes from the states of the Middle East or failed states in remote regions. That if the jihadist movements are defeated, the threat of terror will subside, at least for the foreseeable future. That terrorists will be confined to low-technology weapons, at least for the foreseeable future. That because they will be so confined, terrorists pose at most a modest threat to the stability of modern societies. And that we should address this threat by concentrating on the likeliest assaults rather than spending and organizing for the remote possibility that terrorists will pull off a truly catastrophic attack. That the forces required to deal with terrorists are completely unrelated to the forces required to deal with natural disasters like hurricanes, or epidemics, tidal waves, earthquakes. And above all, that the wars against terror really have nothing to do with such state-centric activities as ethnic cleansing or genocide or the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or non-political events like power outages, catastrophic weather, tsunamis, epidemics, and other civilian catastrophes. Is there anyone present in this auditorium who does not hold at least some of these assumptions? Well, the notion I think that is most widely held, and the one that most disturbed me, and the one I'll talk about for about 10 minutes now, is that the idea of a war on terror simply doesn't make sense. Why do we believe this? Let me read you something from the editor of El País, who's quite a thoughtful commentator. He wrote, "Here in Spain, we don't feel as if we're at war because we aren't. And neither are the inhabitants of the United States, however vociferously many Americans may insist that they are. War is something else entirely. No normal life can be led while war is going on. The Madrileños, who lived through the siege of their city from 1936 to 1939, know that very well. The survivors of the daily bombardments of London during the Second World War know it too. And those Americans who participated in that war, they know it also. There is no war against terrorism. There can be no such thing against an enemy that remains dormant most of the time and is almost never visible. It's simply another of life's inevitable troubles. And all we can do as we continue to combat it is repeat Cervantes' famous phrase, paciencia y barajar. Have patience and keep shuffling the cards. And there are characteristics of conventional warfare besides its mass destruction that cast doubt on the idea of a war against terror. This is a paragraph written in the Times Literary Supplement by a friend of mine who's a British journalist. There is no war on terror. There is no enemy army. There can be no negotiation, no treaty, and no peace. Terrorism is indeed a nuisance, a weapon, a technique of conflict, as old as war itself, but it is not war. At present, it is, I think, significant that in the years that followed the attacks on September the 11th, very little violence and death has ensued. And that makes us also think that we're not at war. Despite the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, fewer deaths in warfare have occurred in these years than at any time during the wars of the 20th century. To give you just a benchmark, during the Second World War, on average, 16,000 persons were killed every day of the conflict. Furthermore, despite a murderous campaign against Americans that began well before September the 11th, the number of Americans killed by international terrorists since the late 1960s is about the same as the number killed during that period by lightning or by allergic reactions to peanuts. Despite a series of terrorist attacks on London, Casablanca, Madrid, Rome, and many other cities, the total number of persons worldwide who've been killed by terrorists is about the same number as those who drown in bathtubs in the U.S. So one could rationally conclude that it would be neurotic to worry about the survival of the constitutional democracy from a threat from terrorists. Finally, the character of terrorism seems more appropriate to treatment by crime, as crime rather than as warfare. One hears this a lot in Europe. Europeans say they know terrorism in a way that we don't. They've lived through terrorism in much of the last century, and the way we have responded is characteristic of society that has not had that experience and that has overreacted or perhaps panicked. Well, I want to persuade you that this very sensible intuition on our part is wrong. And I want to do it by looking at each of those three elements in the phrase winning a war against terror. First, I want to look at terrorism, and then warfare, and then victory. Let's take terrorism. When the Europeans say they know terrorism, what they mean is they know 20th century nation-state national liberation terrorism. They know the IRA, they know the PKK, they know the FLN, they know ETA, they know the PLO. That's what they're thinking about. They're thinking about a certain form of terrorism that was characteristic of a certain period in the life of the state, a period that begins at the end of the last century and is now coming to an end. They are not thinking, for example, about the sectarian mercenaries who sacked Rome in 1527. Erasmus wrote to Sadoleto saying, not just a city, but a whole world has been destroyed. They're not thinking about the sectarian terrorist who destroyed Antwerp in 1576. Antwerp at that time was the greatest financial center in Europe. It never recovered. These groups were intensely sectarian. They were mercenaries because the kind of state of that period, the 16th century, the princely state, was intensely sectarian and employed mercenaries. It's no coincidence that the people who raped, murdered, and pillaged Antwerp were Catholics. They were mercenaries from the Catholic tertios. By contrast, it's no secret that the Lutheran Landsknecht were the ones who kept the Pope imprisoned at Castel Sant'Angelo when Rome was destroyed. People who say they know terrorism are not thinking about the terrorist of the 17th century, that we think of as the Pirates of the Caribbean. These pirates razed Panama, They destroyed a number of cities in the Caribbean itself. They thought of themselves as sovereigns, and they said so. They set up juries and judges. They wrote constitutions for their pirate crews. They were characteristic of a period in the life of the state that we call the kingly state, because they saw themselves as small kings. People who say they know terrorism are not thinking about the terrorists of the 18th century. In this country, the Native American savages who were employed by colonial territorial states. They're not thinking about the Barbary pirates who negotiated tribute and extortion with territorial states, because that's the way these states conducted the diplomacy and confrontations of their era. They're not even thinking about the anarchist of the 19th century, anarchists who killed an American president, a Spanish king, a French president, they killed the Tsar. The anarchists were the largest party in the Spanish Civil War. What happened to them? What happened to the anarchists in Russia, in Austria, in Germany? Were they defeated? No. They went away when the kind of state they were fighting, the imperial state nations of the 19th century, was destroyed in the First World War. And they were replaced by fascists and communists in the Spanish Civil War because those movements were characteristic of the 20th century nation state. The nation state is militaristic. It is hierarchical. It is intensely nationalistic. And it has produced a terrorism in the PLO and the FLN and so on that is also intensely nationalistic and militaristic, a military wing and a political wing. They call each other colonel. Quite hierarchical, quite territorial. But states are changing. This state is changing. The European Union is changing. Professor Dennis Patterson here has written a very important book on trading with the new forms of the state. I call this new form a market state. And it is characterized by a different basis for legitimacy than the nation state within which we now live. Nation states said, give us power and we will improve your material well-being. Market states say, give us power and we will maximize your opportunities. They replace conscription with an all-volunteer force. They sell off and privatize national monopolies. They deregulate industry. But most importantly, they deregulate women's reproduction. We live in nation states today, but it doesn't take much imagination to see the market state on the horizon. Nor does it take much imagination to see that Al-Qaeda is the first of the market state terrorists. Because like the market state, it is global, it is networked, it outsources and privatizes its activities, and it depends upon very lethal weapons. Now let's look at warfare. Terrorism is becoming more warlike. For five centuries, since the Renaissance, when the first modern states emerged, it has taken a state to destroy another state. Every state knew that its only lethal enemy, other than its own people, would come from another state. Because only states could keep armies in the field, sometimes for decades, could master complex logistics and develop new and more lethal technologies. That's still true today, but it won't be true for long. It will soon be the case that relatively small groups of persons who are maybe employed by a state, who may act in league with the state, or who may be entirely independent of any state, will be able to do the kind of harm to our cities that previously only armies and states could do. While terrorism is becoming more warlike, war is becoming more like terror. When General Tommy Franks, in a phrase he must wince to remember, said that the end of major combat operations had occurred in Iraq, we had lost 146 men. He wasn't lying to us. He was thinking about a particular kind of operation, sort of the parenthesis around the 20th century. He was thinking about the sorts of wars that we waged in Europe and in Asia in that century. For those wars, if you captured the capital, if the enemy army surrendered, if you defenestrated the political leader, if you occupied the country, you won the war. It was over. But we've lost more than 4,000 men since then, and the war is plainly not over. Let's look at victory. We're inclined to think of victory, at least, If terror is changing in warfare, surely victory must be the same, because victory amounts to winning. And the scenes of victory are oddly the same. If you read the accounts of Armistice Day in London, they sound so much like the accounts of VE Day in the same city, or VJ Day in New York. Bunting everywhere, pretty girls kissed, sailors' caps thrown in the air, the doxology sung in a hushed cathedral. Because the elements of the celebration of victory are very much the same. And when the news came to London of Waterloo, a very similar experience took place. But victory is more than the celebration of victory. Victory really means securing the war aim. And the war aim also changes with the constitutional order. The war against terror will not be a war for natural resources, or to silence any particular ideology, or to replace it with any particular point of view, or to seize territory. It will be a war to protect human choice. And that means the war aim will be to protect civilians. Victory of this kind does not culminate in a peace conference. It has to be won each day. And you know you're winning by the things that don't happen. So I believe when we appreciate these changes in reality, that the semantics will follow. Whereas right now we're pursuing, on both sides of this argument, a notion that if we have the right semantics, we can somehow govern reality. The administration says there's a war on terror, but they have not increased the size of the army. They have not raised taxes. They have not brought Democrats into the war cabinet. They have not done the things that we associate with warfare, as if the semantics were sufficient. I don't believe that the world changed on September the 11th, 2001. I think it had already changed in 1990, and that 9/11 was the consequence of this. And I think the wars we fought in the 20th century that ended in 1990 will be very unlike the wars in the first part of the 21st century. The wars on terror will be composed of three different conflicts. One, a struggle against global, networked, market state terrorism, of which Al-Qaeda is the first, but by no means the last example. Second, a struggle to prevent the development, acquisition, and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, especially biological weapons, but also nuclear weapons. And finally, an effort to prevent the gross diminution of human rights, whether by genocide or ethnic cleansing, but also by natural catastrophes or by occurrences like epidemics that we can't determine either to have been natural or non-natural. When these three developments, the changing nature of terrorism, the widening proliferation of WMD, and the heightened vulnerability of our tangible and intangible infrastructures interact, we face a truly threatening prospect. The effort to preclude the interaction of these elements is the unifying motive force behind wars against terror. But this raises a terrible problem. Progress against any one of these challenges tends to exacerbate the situation in the other two. So intervention to stop the proliferation of weapons may stimulate terrorist activity, as it has in Iraq. Intervention to protect human rights may actually stimulate nuclear and biological proliferation, as it has in Iran and North Korea. Action against terrorists, as in Afghanistan, may both increase proliferation and its threat, as it has in Pakistan, or, as in Somalia, make human rights abuses even worse. We must be ready for this as a public, because it is a very demanding intellectual as well as political agenda. But in the meantime, we must step back and ask the most basic questions about wars on terror. Do we know how to win such wars in the way that we knew what we had to do to defeat the fascist in World War II? Are we developing new strategic doctrines of the kind we had to develop to contain the Soviet Union in the Cold War? Most importantly, are we writing new international law, new domestic law, and creating new legal institutions to cope with global problems, as we did at the end of the First World War? I think the answer to all these questions is evident. Though it may seem that we are in a race against our enemy, Al-Qaeda, we are, in fact, in a race against time. for time will bring forth new and more lethal terrorist threats long after al-Qaeda is defeated, as it will be. We must configure our forces to respond when we don't know and can't find out whether the source of a catastrophic event is a natural event or one caused by terrorists or the act of a precocious California teenager. One cannot say precisely how long we have, but we must urgently begin this fundamental rethinking. Thank you.
Well, my presentation may be fairly short because I think I agree with almost everything Professor Bobbitt said, so we can probably go home right now. What I set out to do in my book was to look, I guess, with a somewhat less historical sweep than Professor Bobbitt did, at the remarkable period after 9/11, the aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and the government's response to it, and really this tension between the intense desire and understandable desire by the U.S. government to stop another attack, and the strains that placed on the constitutional system at work, the expectations of due process, for instance, and Fourth Amendment protections. And as Professor Bobbitt mentioned, this pendulum shift that we've often come to, the metaphor we've often come to use between times of national security crisis and civil liberties, and the feeling that after a time of crisis, that pendulum often shifts towards the side of national security, and that the two somehow cannot coexist. What I looked at was the way the government responded in terms of really human dramas. I tried to put a human face on this from my reporting at the New York Times, and before that at the LA Times, where I'd worked for 15 years, and I was actually working at the LA Times on 9/11. And not in judgmental terms, but just in the storyteller's terms, to look at the pressures on people at the FBI and the National Security Agency and the White House and the Department of Homeland Security after that was created, and look at the very real dramas that were playing out and the very real tensions that were dividing the government at that time. We didn't know many of these tensions at the time. I mean, that's sort of the fascinating part of being able to step back now and write a book, as I've done, is that as these stories were playing out privately in secret in 2002 and 2003, they were hidden from public view. The front that was presented from the administration was of a united government, of a facade of solidarity, that there was never any question about this fight against the war on against Al Qaeda and in the war on terror. There were never any divisions within the government over how the war should be prosecuted, over the limits of the law allowing the president to do what he was doing. In fact, we now know that there were intense debates within the government through reporting at my paper, reporting that I've done, and reporting elsewhere. I tell the story in my book of really what I see as kind of a metaphor for the whole last 7 years. Within hours of the 9/11 attacks, the officials at the highest levels met at the FBI, at the FBI's Emergency Command Headquarters, and were debating, what do we do now? The Twin Towers have just collapsed. We have no idea whether or not there are sleeper cells within the United States. What do we do now? And there was an effort afoot to basically do door-to-door sweeps within Muslim neighborhoods to question, interrogate, and perhaps imprison people within Muslim neighborhoods like in Dearborn, Michigan, whether or not they're American citizens, if they might have some suspected link to al-Qaeda, or even those without any obvious suspected link to al-Qaeda. And there was a dramatic moment that I talk about in the book where the head of the INS at that time, James Ziegler, who was a conservative, who was a Barry Goldwater conservative who had been in the government for on and off for about 30 years at that point, stood up at the FBI and said, the INS will not be a part of that. what you are suggesting is unconstitutional. This is akin to what the British royalty imposed on colonial America in terms of door-to-door searches and general warrants. And he said, you know, with a fist-stomping, resounding defiance, that the INS would not be a part of it. This was, again, hours after the Twin Towers had fallen, and we had here our first clash between the desire, again, the very understandable desire to stop another attack, and this tension, this constitutional tension over how far the government could go and how far the limits of the law could be stretched in stopping another attack. So what I set out to do was to really tell that story in as vivid a hue as I could. And the book tries to operate on two planes, both those human stories of the people within the executive branch and also the story of the media from a reporter's perspective, the role that the media played. And I think that's in many ways equally fascinating and something I have more direct knowledge of because of my own role. The national mood, if you remember back to the months and even the early years after 9/11, you know, there was outrage, there was revulsion over what had happened, there was sort of a bloodthirsty cry for revenge in those early months. How could this happen? Who had done this? How are we going to make sure that this does not happen again? The media was certainly infected by those same feelings. You know, we are citizens first and reporters second to some extent. And I think and I argue in the book that in those early months and even in the first year or two, a lot of our inherent skepticism as reporters really abandoned us, that when the White House and when the Justice Department, when the FBI would talk about the latest threat of the day, the latest flavor of al-Qaeda's attack, we were not quick enough to ask the questions that we should have been asking. Gay Talese talked in his book, The Power in the Kingdom, about the reporters having an innate ability to see the warts on the world. You know, it's our skepticism that makes us reporters, to say, hey, what about that, and ask that second question. You know, there's the old joke that if you get a tip from your mother, you write it down, but you get a second source. You know, that's our temperament. But that abandoned, I think, a lot of us, myself included, after 9/11. I remember sitting at a congressional hearing in early 2003. This was not months after 9/11, but close to a year and a half after 9/11, when John Ashcroft, who was then the Attorney General, gave a fairly dramatic bit of testimony. He was on the defensive at that point over the Patriot Act and turned the tables on his accusers, as Ashcroft was very good at doing, and dramatically unsealed a court indictment that had been secret until that very morning and said that he was announcing at this congressional hearing that there was an indictment against a couple of clerics in Yemen with direct ties to bin Laden. One of them may have hand-delivered $20 million to Osama bin Laden. And there were ties between this cleric and a mosque in Brooklyn, which had been directly involved, Ashcroft said, in delivering money to al-Qaeda and, by implication, to bin Laden himself. And this was big news. I remember running out of the congressional hearing room in the Dirksen Senate office building before the testimony was even over and getting my assignment editor on the phone before they went into their noon meeting and saying, you know, hold a spot on the front page, you know, just like the old front page movies that you've seen. And, you know, the story ran at the top of the front page, Brooklyn Mosque tied to al-Qaeda, as did virtually every other media organization. And within about a year, once the case actually wound its way through court and, you know, the government was, lo and behold, was required to put on evidence, the ties to this Brooklyn Mosque were non-existent. There was, in fact, evidence tying this cleric, who Ashcroft had talked about, to Hamas, but the ties to al-Qaeda were very, very shaky, and the ties to this Brooklyn Mosque were invisible. Never, as far as the jury was concerned, never happened. And there was episode after episode where we began to see that. Many of you probably remember the case of Jose Padilla, the radioactive dirty bomber. Again, it was Ashcroft, this was in 2002, who announced in a live hookup from Moscow with an orange glow over his head, that this Jose Padilla character, he used his Islamic taken name, was planning to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb on the streets of America, and that this plan was in the works, and that they had arrested him and detained him. And they would eventually detain him as an enemy combatant. They would jail him in a military brig in South Carolina, keep him without charges, without access to a lawyer for 3.5 years before actually charging him. Now, once they actually put him in the criminal court system, gave him a lawyer, let him know what the charges were against him, this radioactive plot never had any role in the charges against him. He was charged in a plot that barely, did not resemble at all the much-hyped original plot that Ashcroft had talked about in this live hookup from Moscow. And, you know, we in the media, I think, were as gullible and perhaps as naive as we were at the beginning. After seeing enough of these cases collapse and dissemble, I think we finally began to get our old ways about us and to get our bearings back and to say, you know, we can't believe every story we hear. I'm not suggesting necessarily, I know many people have, that these threat reports were intentionally hyped. There's some evidence to support that. I won't try and get inside the, you know, absent a smoking gun to suggest that was actually happening. I won't suggest that here. But certainly the facts did not stand up in the light of day in many of these cases. And the truth is that we wrote far too many stories in the early months and years after 9/11 about, as I said, the threat of the day. These were easy pickings to get on the front page with FBI intelligence reports about Al-Qaeda being ready to strike off the Pacific using scuba divers or using helicopter tourists. Guides or using hazmat trucks or crop dusters. We wrote story after story about these, even though the evidence, you know, may have been thin at best to support the idea that these were real plots. The allegory to this, I'm sure many of you are already thinking, is the coverage of Iraq and WMD, which thankfully I was not all that involved with in that same period. But as we were covering the war on terrorism and the war on terror at home, we were also covering the buildup to the war and WMD abroad in Iraq. And I think there was a national mood at play which influenced the media's coverage. I think that began to change around, I would trace it to around 2004, when we began to see a whole series of stories where the media became much more aggressive and I think, again, got its bearings back. And we began to see stories out of Iraq, for instance, about the Abu Ghraib abuses, which is a story that CBS and 60 Minutes broke. We began to see stories out of Guantanamo Bay about issues of due process and interrogation of prisoners. We began to see stories about waterboarding, which my paper first broke and first used that term in 2004. We began to see stories about CIA secret prisons. We were covering the threat at the same time. You know, we weren't blind to the threat of Al-Qaeda, which was and remains very real to this day. You know, as best we can, we cover the threat as it changes in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, along the borders, in Southeast Asia. You know, as best we can get our arms around the threat and how it's evolving. And we're not immune to that. You know, we're not suggesting that the threat is imagined. It is very real, and there are Islamic extremists who clearly mean to do us harm. But I think we've, in the last few years, begun to cover the other side of that, which is how has the government gone about attacking this problem, and what are the costs of the war on terror? My most direct involvement in this whole issue was in the issue of the NSA's warrantless surveillance program, which we first began hearing rumblings about in early 2004. My partner and I at the Times, Jim Risen, separately actually began hearing about nervousness, anxiety within the government about some mysterious intelligence program that was causing, seemed like, an intense anxiety within the government. Over the sense that the legal limits were really being stretched to the brink. And it took us a while to put together what this was really about. And even once we did, even once we had a fairly good grasp about what this program was, and it was a program that by which the president had authorized the NSA to go around the court system in approving warrants on Americans who we believed were tied to al-Qaeda. Even once we did have our arms around what this program was, there was then, of course, the question of, is the paper going to run this story? It was so sensitive and such a covert program. The White House immediately went to the top editors at the paper and urged us in dire terms not to run the story, saying that the mere mention in the New York Times of anything connected to this would cost Americans' lives, would do dire harm to the war on terror and national security. And that's a plea that no editor, at least no responsible editor, is going to take lightly, and ours did not. We felt, the reporters felt, that the story could and should run. Our editors disagreed in the first go-around. They were not comfortable running the story. And I talk at some length about sort of this agonizing internal debate over whether to run the story. Eventually, a year after that initial round of discussions in late 2005, the editors shifted course and decided that they were going to run the story. And the White House was, needless to say, not happy about that. Let us know that if there was another attack after that, after our story ran, there would be blood on our hands. That stops you in your tracks when you hear that from a senior White House official. But I think the paper came out on the right side of that debate, and I think that the last couple of years have borne out the paper's decision to publish that story. I mean, we're at a time of really a dramatic public debate over the war on terror and how it should be waged, checks and balances, and what the role of Congress should be. And that's an important point that let me spend a few minutes on. I think in both the NSA story and in a major follow-up story that I did on another secret program, another program that the White House asked us not to write about involving a CIA program getting access to banking records. In both those situations, front and center was really the question of the president's claim to almost unchecked, omnipotent authority with very little in the way of congressional oversight. Before we were about to run the second story on the CIA's banking program, the administration started going to a bunch of members of Congress and the banking committees who they had not bothered to brief when this program started years earlier and called them in for briefings. Barney Frank was one of them, who was the head of the banking committee, the Financial Services Committee at that point. And Frank was a little confused as to what this briefing was about and why he was just getting this now. What is this SWIFT program? This was the name of the consortium in Belgium that the CIA had tapped into to get access to all these banking records. And he said, is this a program that's just starting? Well, no, it's actually been going on for a while. Well, are you doing something new with it? No, nothing new. What is it, going to pop in the media or something? Well, yeah, it is. And is that why you're now briefing me on this? And they finally admitted that, yes, it was because the story was about to appear in the New York Times that they were getting around to briefing members of Congress on this. Frank kind of laughed at them and said, you know, next time you want to brief me about a program that's not going to be in the New York Times, you let me know. He just walked out of the room and closed the door. So a major strain in all of these stories that we've been doing is the idea that the administration has really shot itself in the foot, in the view of many people, by ignoring the normal checks and balances and oversight that comes with the territory. And that was a theme that I ran into time and time again in interviewing the people that I did for the book. I think that in the first year or so after 9/11, the administration was given wide berth to do whatever it took to stop another attack. And I think a lot of the steps it took would have been no different than any administration, had it been Democrat or Republican, had it been an Al Gore administration who was elected in 2000, say George Bush. I think that many of the programs in terms of the invasion of Afghanistan, the interrogation tactics, surveillance tactics, might have been very, very similar in those early months and years when again, there was such wide latitude given to the president. The people that I was interviewing, though, said they became uncomfortable with just how long that period of basically a state of emergency was allowed to continue, that there was an indefinite state of war essentially declared. And there was a pushback by people within the administration a year or so out, at no specific point, but in different programs, the NSA surveillance program, the interrogation programs, to say, can't we get more congressmen involved in this? Can't we get a clearer legal justification? Can't we firm up the legal opinions from the Justice Department? Can't we get our programs more in line with judicial opinions? And the response in the White House generally was, we are going to go it alone. There's a famous line, or it's now become sort of famous in some circles, from Vice President Cheney's counselor, David Addington, in describing this broad mindset, saying that that we're going to push and push and push until someone pushes back. And that was essentially the mindset for the first 4 years or so in the War on Terror, until Congress and the courts in big decisions like the Hamdan decision and the media began to look at some of these programs and scrutinized what was being done. And the sad lesson, I think, in a lot of ways, was that these were, in many respects, were things that could have been done, could have been accomplished in with more or less the same outcome had there been more in the way of oversight and checks and balances, and less in the way of this go-it-alone muscularity and this omnipotent reading of the president's wartime authority. In many ways, that was and remains self-defeating. So, with that, I think we're going to open it up to questions. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think you know how this works. If you raise your hand, we will get a mic to you. We have very limited time for questions, so we'll just take a handful. Who would like to start us off? Gentleman about six rows back with his hand up.
Last week I heard Professor Bernard Lewis say that Osama bin Laden was totally surprised by the American response to 9/11, and I've heard others say that was exactly what he was looking for, and that the destruction of the United States since then, or our deteriorating status since then, has made it unnecessary for them to respond any further. Whereas he had said, Bernard Lewis said, that we really, because of Osama bin Laden's shock at our response, has helped to prevent any further attacks. Which is the true position?
I haven't talked to Osama bin Laden lately, so
I'm afraid I don't know. I mean, we know from bin Laden's statements that he expected that an attack of this kind would cause the U.S. to withdraw support for some of its allies in the region. He said he took this lesson away from Lebanon, where we, in my mind, unwisely went in and then unwisely left, but as to what his real reaction is, I'm afraid I couldn't say.
Yeah, I just don't remember whether. I mean, there were certainly statements post 9/11 where bin Laden, expressed tremendous satisfaction with the results, was essentially gloating over 9/11, and I'm trying to remember if he was not surprised that we had gone into Afghanistan, but I don't remember specifically enough to answer your question.
Another question? Gentleman here in the third row.
At the time of 9/11 and for several years after, I was living in London. And the perception was that the American media was the cheerleader for everything that Lyra in the White House did. And when he waved the flag, you people just stood up and saluted. Now, I'm wondering now, why was this innocence, I won't say collusion, with the media and the Lyra in the White House?
I'd like Philip to answer that. Well, it certainly was not intentional. I think it was naivete more than anything. I think it's almost inevitable, and this was my experience, my first experience living through, you know, the aftermath of a national crisis and how that gets reported out in the media. But I think, you know, from talking to more veteran reporters, I think that's the cycle that's almost inevitable after in times of war, in times of national crisis. I think the media reflects the national mood, whether you like it or not. And the national mood after 9/11 was one of, you know, rally around the president, rally around the country. There's Bush standing up in the fire trucks at 9/11 saying we're going to take the fight to Al-Qaeda. There was such intense second-guessing after 9/11 about why the intelligence community had failed to connect the dots that all of our energies in the media and all of the energies of the government itself were focused on connecting the dots after 9/11. Even if those dots may have been, made up.
Gentleman right back here in the red hat.
Professor Bobbitt, I wasn't bold enough to hold up my hand when you gave us that long list of assumptions about terrorism, but your book pushes me a long way in that direction. To the extent that I understand it,
I'm sure you understand.
Which it's a difficult book filled with difficult concepts and sometimes, for me, difficult words. But what I'd like to ask you, and I've thought of other books like Rupert Smith's book on warfare and Judge Posner's book. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But what I would like to ask you is there anyone in the government, the American government, or in the British government, and I would include the judiciary and the Congress, who thinks anywhere along the lines that you're thinking? It seems to me that you're different from just about everybody else. And I'm wondering if, I hope I'm not the only one citizen from Philadelphia, that thinks that you might be right. And
I hope you're not the
most,
only one, too.
And the most important thing is for us to get going on changing our laws and our constitutional ideas before something catastrophic happens, because I agree with you. If there's a catastrophe, everybody's going to be safe. They're not going to care about some of the things we're caring about right now. Thank you, and I hope I'm not too long.
Of course, I think you're exactly on target. This is a period of relative tranquility. This is the time when we need to be debating these issues in public, before the Congress, passing laws for an emergency that one hopes will never be needed. I think in the book I use the phrase stockpiling laws the way we stockpile vaccines. There are a number of measures, simple measures as well as complex ones. I'll give you just one small example. If we were to lose 6 members of the Supreme Court through an attack. I know you don't mean that. And if you do, then I'm ashamed that you said it because it's a shameful thing to say. If we lost members of the Supreme Court, whether you agree with them or not, we would find it very difficult to reconstitute the court in a short period of time. Their successors have to be located, nominated, confirmed, and then put into office. Yet with a single statute, we could provide for the chief judges of the 13 circuit courts to constitute an emergency court if the number of Supreme Court justices went below 5 or 4 or something of that kind. That's a very simple statutory fix so that in the case of an emergency, we're not floundering around. We're not having to act
just simply on executive authority. Martial law or reliance just on executive authority is the antithesis of the rule of law. And the rule of law is what we're really fighting about. You also ask in that question, did I think there was anyone who thought as I do? I think there are a great many people who do. You mentioned Rupert Smith, General Smith. I thought Tony Blair, when he was in office, had a good read on this stuff, though he's not in office now. And some of the people I served from the NSC, Steve Simon, who was the senior director for counterterrorism, I always thought had a good read on all this, and sort of taught me a lot.
Philip, I wonder if you could dilate a bit on something in Eric's book, or something that you say in your book, which is that there have been these missteps in terms of the way that the law has been prosecuted with regard to civil rights. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little more, because it seemed like you think that is clearly an issue, and yet within the context of the broader idea of confronting terror, that it's not as problematic.
I do think that the sort of pendulum idea that we all share, I certainly share this idea, is insufficient, that it is kind of a half-truth. You know, I teach constitutional law, so I perhaps would fall back on this example. When our Constitution was adopted, the Federalists went to ratification conventions in each of the states, including here in Philadelphia, to persuade the public to ratify the 1789 Constitution in lieu of the Articles of Confederation that hitherto had governed our country. And they got a lot of pushback from our people. Patrick Henry in Virginia, George Wise, Sam Adams in Boston, who said, why do we want a stronger government? We just got rid of a stronger government. What we want are our rights. That's what we fought for. And what James Madison said, and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, what Washington himself said was, you have to strengthen the government to protect your rights. The Declaration of Independence gives only one purpose for government, and that is to protect our rights. And it is not the case that the weaker the government, the greater your rights. And Somalia is Exhibit A. Nor is it the case that the stronger the government, the weaker your rights. My students, for example, hate the idea of carrying a national identity card. Liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, they just hate this notion. It always puzzles me because when I was their age, I was trying to get an ID card. But that's a different issue. This is the sort of measure we can take that strengthens the government, but I think it also strengthens our rights on many, many levels. So it isn't really a simple zero-sum game.
Eric, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I think that I agree that it's too often cast as an either-or, that either you have to be on the side of national security or on the side of civil liberties, and the truth is that it's a bit of a bumper sticker cliche, but in an ideal world, you can have both. I think, you know, as I was saying earlier, that's sort of the I think the sad lesson of what we've seen the last few years is that the tactics that have been used in sort of defying legislative oversight the last few years have sort of had the effect of sacrificing civil liberties unnecessarily when there was an easier way.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll end with this lady right here in the third row. Ma'am, if you could wait for the microphone, please. Thank you. No, you know what? We're recording this, so if you could please wait for the microphone.
It's my feeling that the Bush administration lit a match to the Middle East. Not that we didn't have problems there, but by walking into Iraq, did we walk in? We exacerbated the entire situation.
Would either of you like to comment on that?
Well, I don't see how one can deny what you said. I mean, I supported the intervention in Iraq. I still support it. I think that the strategy we have now is is the right strategy, though it's taken us a long time to get it. I beg your pardon?
Sir, could you keep your comments to yourself while the gentleman speaks?
But it's my view that we've made the situation a great deal worse, not just in Iraq, but also, as you say, throughout the region. I don't think that had to happen. I don't think that if we had had a clear idea about what kind of force structure was required, if we knew what our war aim was in the way that I've described, I don't think this had to have turned out as badly as it has turned out thus far. But I may be wrong.
Time will tell. Folks, we are out of time. Thank you very much for coming. Please thank Philip Bobbitt and Eric Lichtblau.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.